Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Welcome, Lynn Cherry. Lynn, I have to start by telling you that my spouse, the lovely Roselle, when she heard that you were going to be here, said, she's very famous, you know. So tell us about Sustainability Day.
We did a dry run of the Sustainability Day last year. And the idea was that there are a lot of towns all throughout the U.S. that are trying to become more energy independent. So that's the main reason for having this. And so what we did last year, and we'll be doing some of the same this year, is that we'll be showing a film called Chasing Ice, and it's about the melting of the Arctic. It was my friend James Balog is in that movie, and he was a photographer. He is a photographer, but he decided he needed to alert the people to what was happening, and so he took these time-lapse photos, and you can see those on the internet, really remarkable. But it kind of leaves you with a heavy heart at the end. And so then the next film that we'll be showing will be called Deep Green. And that is a movie about success stories all around the world of places that have gotten off fossil fuel. There's an island off the coast of Denmark, completely energy independent. In Germany, they are going to renewables. China, you can't build a house without having solar hot water. And so then after that, we'll be showing the Young Voices for the Planet films, which are about young people who are finding solutions to the climate crisis and reducing CO2 emissions. And there are 8 of these films. Actually, there are 9 of these films now. And the last one, which is called Longing for a Local Lunch, is about 4 students in Great Barrington at Monument Mountain High School who realize that when you get food from really far away, that it burns a lot more carbon. And so that adds to climate change. But also, the food that they're getting just wasn't very good. Wasn't very nutritious or didn't taste that good. So they decided they wanted fresh, local produce and vegetables from just around Great Barrington. And they've been successful in getting 1 local lunch day every month and then at least 1 local vegetable or fruit or something local, meat, into their cafeteria fare every day. So that's that story.
Now, Lynchar, you have written several books, and that's where you got your original fame for all of this. How Groundhog's Garden Grew, Flute's Journey, The Life of a Wood Thrush, How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate with Gary Bresch, El Mar, La Tormenta y El Manglar, which is?
The Sea, the Storm, and the Mangrove Tangle. In English.
In English. And, of course, The Great Kapok Tree, A Tale of the Amazon Rainforest. So where do you come up with these subjects? How do you decide what you're doing next?
I've asked myself, what in the world are the most pressing issues? And of these issues, what are issues that we can actually have a solution to? And what are the issues, if we have a solution to, that kids could actually participate in that solution? So that's been how...
So why is it so important to get the kids when they're kids, as opposed to try to do it later?
Well, as a children's book author, illustrator, I've traveled all around. I give talks. And when I meet these kids, they want to do something. You know, they feel sometimes kind of depressed. You know, they can't help hearing about what's happening in the world.
And what their future is going to look like.
That's right. And so I feel... Well, initially, I would just tell them about the problems, and then I very soon realized that that just got them pretty depressed, and it wasn't really very productive. But when I told them success stories about other kids, like 40,000 acres in the rainforest have been saved by kids who raised money for saving rainforest, like the Monteverde Rainforest, the Bosque Eterno de los Niños. In A River Ran Wild, that's a book about the Nashua River in Massachusetts, and that covers the whole span of history because it's an environmental history, but then it goes up to the 50s and then the 60s, where it's a community of people who save that river, who clean it up. And they actually are instrumental in getting an Environmental Protection Agency created and the Clean Waters Act, which then led to the National Clean Waters Act. But it was kids bringing these bottles of river water to the governor and saying, look at this. You know, this is, and they would testify. They'd say, we just want this river the way it was when you were kids. You could fish in it. You could swim in it and you could drink it. So kids are, they're so earnest and they have a moral compass. It's not like talking to an adult who will often have an agenda. They don't have an agenda except they just want a future.
You want to teach a kid a foreign language, do it early. Mm-hmm. We all know that. And so you're doing much of the same thing. So when are you going to write a book about my favorite hero of all time, Pete Seeger?
Well, that's funny that you ask that, because I was thinking of writing a book about the Hudson River.
Sure.
But before I get to doing that, I'm actually working on a movie that involves Pete Seeger. It's one of the Young Voices for the Planet films. And he's been working with a group of kids called the Rivertown Kids Chorus.
Indeed, we know it well.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Okay. And, well, he's such an amazing role model. So I've been going to a lot of the rehearsals, and I filmed them. And so that's my upcoming film, is about Pete and the Rivertown Kids Chorus. And they sing out to be heard. They sing out to just talk about issues that they want the adults to do something about.
Well, with the Clearwater, he's done much of the same thing that you're doing in terms of environmental studies. And I remember one line on an Arlo Pete record in which he says, "And they're swimming in the Hudson again." When people get together, as soon as they get together, they're doing politics, he said. I love that line. And I've often thought of it.
That is really amazing when you think about how these, all in all the rivers, it's really all the rivers with industrialization, they just became
sewers.
Oh, they were disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it your sense that we're making progress?
Well, as far as our rivers, absolutely. I mean, in that book, A River Ran Wild, you can see the pictures of the river when it was red, blue, green. It would run whatever color they were, dyeing paper, and it smelled, and it was just disgusting. And there were no laws that made it against the law to do that. And so all these people got together, and they created the Massachusetts First Clean Water Act. And that at least made it illegal to do that. And then the river started to clean itself, and it got clean. And now it's a beautiful, clean river you can swim in and fish in. And it's like the story of the Hudson.
So how do you approach a book? In other words, how do you do it? Because there are people who are listening right now saying, "I'd like to write a book."
Yeah, I know. It's not as easy as it seems. You just think, well, a kid's book, it's simple. But making it simple is the hard part. You know, you tend to just want to put in all this information. And I think that the key is to put in as little information as you can to make the story actually move forward.
As a child, what was your favorite book?
It was How the Mole Got His Pockets.
Really?
Yeah, it was a Czechoslovakian book, and it was about this little mole who was really intrepid, and he wanted this pair of overalls to put all his prize treasures in that he found as he went through the earth. And he got the swallows to help weave it. He got the ants to help cut it. He got the crayfish. I mean, he just got all these animals, each having its own talent, to do part of this making of these overalls. And I read this over and over again, and I think—
How old were you when you were reading this?
Pretty young. I think from the time I was, say, 2 to—
Wow.
So it was really formative, and I didn't realize until I had to write an essay it was a project for the Corcoran Gallery of Art, and we were going to be doing our illustrations in front of all these people, and they wanted to know this about the book that was our favorite book. But in reading it, it made me realize that somehow that was embedded in my young psyche, that you can accomplish things by getting people who have different talents together and working together. And that became part of the fabric of who I was. And as I was growing up, I was just, that's what I was doing, getting people together and trying to change things.
My favorite was Ferdinand.
Ferdinand the Bull.
Because there was so much, I mean, it was such a, without my realizing, a progressive political idea that he didn't want to go to fight. He wanted to just smell flowers.
Mm-hmm. And I think that it was Larson who illustrated. They were beautiful illustrations, those black and white illustrations.
So how does that work, the relationship between people who write books, do the words, and have people doing the illustrations? Or should it always be that the same person does both?
I think it doesn't really matter either way. You know, in the beginning, the first 10 books I did, I just illustrated other people's work. And then the next 20 books I did was my own. I wrote them and illustrated them.
The illustrations are marvelous that you have in these books, and they are very detailed. Mm-hmm. How long does it take you to draw one page?
Forever.
Does it?
Yes. Yeah. But the advantage of writing as well as illustrating is that then you know that you can say some of the things with the pictures, so you don't actually have to include them in the writing. So it really makes it easier to write a book and illustrate it at the same time. And
have you ever worked with a collaborationist, for want of a better word? In other words, have you ever just written the words and had somebody else draw the pictures or not? Never.
No, once I started writing, then I started illustrating, except for that book, How We Know What We Know About Our Changing Climate.
Yes.
And that was illustrated with photographs.
Yes.
But Gary Brasher, he's one of the most famous photographers that there is, And he had started a project called Worldview of Global Warming.
Yeah.
He was one of the first, if not the first, photographers to sound the alert about climate change and
to
document
it. So how did
it
come about, Lynn, Cherry, that you found him or he found you?
Well, we've known each other for about 15 years. So I was aware of him, you know, of this work that he was doing. And in fact, I would travel with him sometimes. We went to the Amazon, to Australia, and he would be traveling with scientists. We would be meeting with the scientists who are actually doing the science, the climate science. And so when you're there and you're seeing the Arctic melting, or you're in Australia and you're seeing all these animals moving up altitudinally to try and get to a place where it's not as warm, and these scientists, you know, you see their data and you recognize that this is really happening, then, you know, you realize that, well, you've got to do something. And so that was, he decided to do it with his photographs, and then we decided to write this book together. And we wrote the book, but the book, I felt, wasn't having enough of an impact in enough time. And I know that young kids, middle school and high school especially, that they're watching television or they're on the internet. Mm-hmm. And so we felt that we needed to get the message to them through the media that they're going to be most likely watching. And that's how the film project was born, through that book. And then as I traveled around the country, kids are always writing to me or coming up to me and saying, you know, we just saved this forest, or we just did this great thing. And I thought we should tell those stories. People should hear these children's voices and see that the kids really care about having a future. They do care about having a future. And so that's what the Young Voices for the Planet films do. The kids are the narrators. There's no adult voice, except for every once in a while, some adult we interview. It's the kids. It's coming from the kids.
We're talking to Lynn Cherry, and I have to tell you, Lynn, you have a name that nobody will ever forget. Are you, it's just a wonderful name, Lynn Cherry. I mean, it rolls off the tongue. Are you pleased that you had that name?
My mother designed my name graphically. My mother is a children's book illustrator, and so she, this is a story she tells it when she was naming me. She said, well, there's two double consonant, descending Ys, and she said she wanted it to stick out on the printed page.
Well, Lynn Cherry is our prize-winning environmental writer and illustrator and producer-director of Young Voices for the Planet. Lynn will be speaking at SUNY Newport Sustainability Day, a day that has been created just to bring all the folks from Newport together and from so many other places so that they can make a change. Thanks so much, Lynn, for joining us, and give us your website.
It's youngvoicesfortheplanet.com.
Again, Lynn, what a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.